This morning, I would like to continue or conclude the series that we've been on for this past number of months now. And we've been talking about knowing God. Knowing God is the title of the series on this attributes of God. Who is God? What is he like? And how do we get to know him? How is it that we know this particular God of the universe, King of Kings and Lord of Lords? This, for the disciple of Christ, is a lifelong pursuit. This is something that ought to occupy our devotional time, ought to motivate us in our daily Christian walk, getting to know him. Know him in all of his glory and his majesty. What I want us to understand this morning, however, that it's one thing to know about God, but it's something else to actually know him. We can know a great deal about him, as we've been talking about in the last number of weeks, but it's another thing to actually get to know him and to walk with him and to honor him and to talk with him and have that kind of a relationship that he invites us to. It depends on the books that you read and the sermons you hear and the Bible studies you have and the church that you go to and the podcasts you listen to. There's all kinds of opportunities for us, but ultimately it's about knowing God, not just about him, but actually knowing him and having communion with him. When a person knows God, all of the losses and the disappointments, the joys and the gains of life become rather insignificant, fade into insignificant meaninglessness. As the Apostle Paul said in his own testimony in Philippians chapter 3, I count all things lost for the great surpassing knowledge of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord. Those things that were gained to me, those things that were losses to me, he says, they are meaningless, they are empty in comparison to knowing Christ. And sometimes we meet people like that across the path of our life. There are people that we interact with who really seem to know God better than I do. I feel that keenly when I'm not there. You think I'm the pastor. Well, I think I am the pastor, but I don't have it all together. There are people that are further ahead than me, and I think that perhaps we all have, or many of you have awareness of an individual that I've known for most of my life who passed away last year, Elva Kenyon. Elva walked with God. She was a model disciple of Christ who knew him intimately and had a walk with him that was profound, deep, rich, and meaningful. And it's good for us to have people like that in our lives, people that you know who really do walk closely with God, and may they be an inspiration to you. We need to know God, but we also know about him and then know him personally. So this morning what I want to do as we conclude this series is talk about the people who know God. What do they look like? What are the marks of those people who really know God and who walk with him? And I'm going to take our thoughts this morning from the book of Daniel. In the past number of weeks, we've been looking around at various passages of Scripture, but this morning we will focus our attention only on Daniel, these 12 chapters where we have some exemplary behavior of these young men who walked with God, who knew him, who trusted him, who were bold for him. Daniel, of course, is the main character of the book that bears his name. Daniel is the author of this book, we believe. Daniel was a young man, along with three friends who were living in Jerusalem at the end of the kingdom of Judah when it came to an end under the king Jehoiakim. The country of Judah was taken into captivity, been prophesied by the prophets for many years before that, unless they repented and returned to God. And so, in Daniel's teen years, maybe early adulthood, the worst thing happened. King Nebuchadnezzar and his armies came to Jerusalem, dominated, overtook the city, and deported many, many people of the Israelites, the Jewish people, into the city of Babylon. Daniel was about 20 years of age. He had three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You probably recognize those names because they were the ones who were thrown into the fiery furnace in Daniel chapter 3. But Daniel and his three friends were young men. They were very capable. They were gifted. They excelled in wisdom and knowledge. They were bright, sharp young men who learned the language of the Babylonians. They learned to speak it perfectly. They learned the customs and the religious system and the cultural biases of the Babylonians. They were bright, smart, and they were godly. They were committed to Jehovah, the one who had been proclaimed by the prophets of Israel for generations. And so Daniel and his three friends are the primary protagonists, if you wish, of this story in Daniel. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and we will see them appear repeatedly through the story. Two famous events, really two very well-known events, and one is the fiery furnace where the three friends were cast into, and the other is Daniel, who was cast in the lion's den, chapter 6 of this book. The book of Daniel offers hope to future generations of God's people. That's really the purpose for which it's been written. It provides a pattern and a promise, and the pattern is that of kingdoms, kings and kingdoms, and human leaders who actually behave really, really badly and become violent in their behaviors towards their people, and especially towards the people of Israel, the people of God. And, of course, through the history of time, this has been a repeated theme that we have seen throughout the generations. In the last 100 years, we have had people who have acted very, very wickedly and hurtful towards believers. It happens today. Countries such as North India, particularly, China, North Korea, some countries of Africa. So the pattern is there, and as we see it demonstrated in the book of Daniel as well as other parts of the Old Testament. But the promise with Daniel is that human beings, while they are faulty and will fall short, ultimately one day God will confront them. God will confront the evil, the beasts who are dominating over the people of God. And so this is the story or the theme of the book of Daniel. So the people who know their God, what are they like? The people who know God, what are the marks of people who walk with God, who are dependent upon Him, who are walking faithfully before Him? Let me give you four this morning. First of all, the people who know God have great energy for God. They are passionate for Him, and they will do things for Him. They will commit to serving Him with their whole lives. Daniel, in chapter 11, towards the end of the book, chapter 11, Okay, I'm sorry. All right. Sure. Yeah. I had problems when I tried to open this morning at home, and I got here, and it worked perfectly fine, so I assumed that it was all on the screen. No problem. Okay. We'll be fine. No, we'll go ahead. No, it's not your fault. It's nobody's fault. Okay. The people who know God have great energy for Him. The book of Daniel chapter 11, I think it's verse 32. The RSV version puts it this way. But the people who know their God shall be strong and do exploits. The people who know God are people who will do great things for Him. They trust Him. They recognize that He is able and capable of managing all the details of their lives. Those who know God, therefore, take action for Him. They respond to the challenges of the day. Understanding that God is able, God will see them through. I had a picture of my daughter and her three girls on the screen. I've been here with you for a year and a half now, and one of my disappointments is you don't know my kids. My kids, whom I'd love to have here to visit, my one daughter came once about a year ago, but they live busy lives, and so I'm trying to reflect on how I was at that stage of life. I didn't care much I cared for my parents, but I didn't go to their church. I didn't go see them very often, and likewise my kids as well, because they're busy. They're active with their own family and responsibilities. My daughter Rachel lives in Regina, and her husband works for Regina City Police Department, and he is in the forensic unit is making a career out of that opportunity. But Rachel is very, very, she's now, 36, mid-30s, Rachel was probably, of all five of our kids, was the one who was potentially the most rebellious. She went to Briarcrest after grade 12, and her mother found a half-empty bottle of vodka in her closet, hidden. She thought it was hidden. All that's just to say that God has done a work in Rachel's life. Today, she has three daughters, and she treats them as her ministry. She has a passion for them, for their livelihood, for their well-being, for their growth, and their maturing in grace and the knowledge of Christ. Every morning when they take the girls to school, they spend a moment, just or seconds, 20, 25 seconds, just praying. The huddle, if they walk them to school, the pray in the car, or the van, if they arrive, when they arrive together, and have a word of prayer, asking God's blessing upon these girls, that God will protect them in all of the potential harms that could come their way in this context. My daughter Rachel has particular unusual boldness. She is not afraid to go and speak to the teacher when sex ed classes come up and everybody's expected to be there. She's not afraid to go and speak to the principal when Pride Month comes around on the calendar. She is gracious, she's courteous, but she's got deep conviction as to how she wants to protect her three girls in a way that will honor God and his purposes for their lives. My point in saying this is to illustrate for you the fact that those who know God have energy for him, energy to raise their kids well, to see that the community, the place where they are living, is positive and for the glory of God. We have some slides now. Thank you, everybody. Okay. Thanks, Brenda. So far, so good. So here we are. This is the second one. We're up to actually the first point. Can you back it up? It's not working. There we go. There she is with her three daughters. This past week, I was listening to a podcast. Do you know that I listen to podcasts regularly? I think I've said that a few times. I try to walk regularly every day, and I occupy the time by listening. I've got about, I think, 35 podcasts that I listen to with some regularity. I came across one this week, and I was fascinated by this interview with a person who was part of this group called Mama Bear Apologetics. And this is a book. I went back to my computer and found the book and made an order on Amazon for my five kids. And the book is called Mama Bear Apologetics, Empowering Your Kids to Challenge Cultural Lies. And I recommend this to you. I've not read it yet, but it's now waiting for me, these five copies, when I get home to Lethbridge late tonight. Dealing with issues of pornography, same-sex attraction, purity culture, gender identity. My point is that those who know God and who walk with God have energy for him, for his honor, for his glory, for his purposes to be achieved. Great energy for God, well, whether it's rearing children or serving in the church or being involved in the community for the glory of God. And so Daniel and his friends are exemplary of this. And you think of Daniel chapter 3, the fiery furnace. Daniel and his three friends were consistently proclaiming the glory of God for his purposes, for his glory, and they were not afraid of the consequences. The theme in Daniel is prayer, actually. Daniel knew God and knew that he was sovereign over all of creation, and the theme of God's sovereignty is repeated throughout the book of Daniel. In Daniel, we find regularity as a man of prayer. And perhaps we're at a place, a stage in life where we're not able to do the things that we once did, but we can still pray. We can pray for God's glory to be revealed. We can pray for God's work to be accomplished, for God's sovereign and providential care over our world to be achieved and to be realized in his time. So the people who know God have great energy for him. Secondly, those who know God have great thoughts of God. have elevated thoughts of him, who he is, and all of his majesty and his glory, and the attributes that we have been talking about over these last number of weeks. In this series, my goal, my objective has been to enlarge our understanding of who God is, to enlarge and to grow our appreciation for him and his majesty, to see that we're created in God's image. God is not created in our image. Too often that's the way in which we view him. We think that because we are weak, he also is. Because we don't know everything, he doesn't know everything either, and so we have to tell him. God has created us in his image. God is great. He is majestic. He is awesome. And he deserves all of our worship, our praise, our adoration. The book of Daniel is a vivid and a repeated demonstration of the sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God, meaning that God is ruler over all of creation. God is the creator. He's the maker of heaven and earth. And therefore, he is sovereignly in control of all of the affairs of our world, even when we don't feel like it. Even when it feels like things are falling apart and out of control, the scripture promises us repeatedly that this theme of God's sovereignty is an absolute truth that we can go back to and we can rely upon. God is sovereign ruler over his universe that he created. And there is nothing but nothing can happen in our world or in our lives without his sovereign hand overseeing that. That's difficult to get our heads around because it appears to us like these affairs of our world and in our lives are the result of human behaviors. And while they are, they're still within the permissive, sovereign purposes of God, the God of Israel. I'm not going to reference all these verses, but you might want to write them down. And let me just look with you at chapter 5 and verse 21. Daniel had seen, had a dream, or rather, the king had had a dream, Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel lived through three kings, through Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, his son, and then the next kingdom which came along and destroyed Babylon, which was the Persians, and King Darius appears. And so Daniel's life overlapped with these three particular rulers. Belshazzar had seen a hand writing on the wall, and he was mystified, and he was stunned, and he was afraid. And I think that would happen to you or I as well if we saw this mysterious hand just appearing, and all it was a human hand writing on the wall, and the writing remained when the hand disappeared. And Belshazzar wanted to know, what in the world does this mean? He didn't understand the language. He didn't understand the writing on the wall. And eventually Daniel was the one who was called upon to come and provide an interpretation. And part of Daniel's interpretation, chapter 5, verse 21, is this. It's a condemnation against Belshazzar. Let's go verse 21. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. Speaking of Belshazzar, he lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes, anyone God wishes. Throughout the book of Daniel, we see these kings, Nebuchadnezzar and Darius. They're conflicted. They're pagan worshipers, so they are persecuting the Christian, the Jewish people, Daniel and his three friends. And then they repent, and they say, yes, your God is greater. Yes, your God is able to save. And then they're filled with arrogance again and pride and begin to assert themselves. So there's this repeated theme throughout the book of Daniel of how these kings, various kings, behaved. Look at chapter 6, verse 26 and 27. Here is Darius's decree, or Darius's declaration, I should say, perhaps, his testimony after Daniel had escaped from the lion's den. Daniel 6, verse 26. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear God, fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. This God is worthy of your worship, says King Darius. My objective, as I said in this series, is to help us to have great thoughts of God so that when we come together to worship, we're singing songs together, we're thinking about the words, we're allowing them to penetrate deeply into our minds and into our hearts, and we in our hearts give glory to this majestic, incomparable God. That's one objective. The other is that when we have our own private prayer time and meditation, that we actually bow before this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God Jehovah, who is sovereign over all of creation, who is absolutely holy, set apart and separate, who is loving, who is grace-filled, who is omnipotent and omniscient. He knows everything, and he does not change. He is immutable. This is the God that we worship this morning. This is the God that we are singing to. And as Elizabeth Elliot wrote, and I've said this to you before, if God were small enough to be understood, he would not be big enough to be worshipped. And so we worship a God who is incomparable, a God who is indescribable, a God who is majestic beyond our human comprehension, but is absolutely deserving of our worship and our adoration. Number three, those who know God have great boldness for God. They have courage. King Darius, in chapter 6, had made a decree. The decree was that no one shall pray to any other god or any other man other than the king, King Darius. He was put up to this by some of his court. And it was under threat of execution if anyone was to defy the king and pray to anyone else. Well, the court knew that Daniel was a man of prayer. The court knew that Daniel was a man who followed God Jehovah. And so Daniel goes to his home, his upper room, and prays, opens the windows and prays. Not just once, but three times every day. He is a man of courage and boldness in the spite of this opposition. And the result, of course, is Darius has to throw him into the den of lions. This was what he had decreed. And the law of the Medes and Persians was unchangeable. And Darius was regretting that he had made this decision and he made this decree. But he had to stick with his word. And he was relieved the next morning when he went to the lion's den and saw that Daniel was untouched from these ferocious lions, who previously, with every other convict who was sent there, were torn to pieces. Daniel survived. He was a man of courage, boldness, and willingness to take risks for God. I saw this firsthand when I was in India back in March. I saw boldness and courage like I have seldom seen. I'll give you one example. This man, who I will name Saji, that's not his real name, had been a banker for, I think, 15 years when God called him to plant a church. Saji planted a church, and it grew. It became known in the community, and so he became a target. Became a target for those radicals who were anti-Christian. Those radicals within the country, and it seemed to be organized, this militia group who target Christians and their churches. I had a meeting just yesterday, a prayer gathering yesterday morning by Zoom with my friend who's leading this ministry in India. And the state of northeastern India state just had 10 Christians executed, killed by mob violence. dozens of churches and homes of Christians burned. Well, this man, Saji, told us his story. He became a known pastor in the community, and he became a target. He was beaten up and charged and put to prison. He was there for several months before his trial came, and he appeared before the judge. And the judge said to him, it was a female judge, and she said, "Why is it you Christians keep showing up here?" And he had the opportunity to share his testimony with her. And then Saji said he had the opportunity to present her with a Bible, a Christian Bible, and she was fascinated. I don't know the end of the story in terms of that experience, but I know that Saji was released. He's back to his home, and he is again preaching the gospel courageously with boldness because he knows God. Those who know God have great boldness and courage for him. It's like the apostles in Acts chapter 5. The apostles and Peter went before the Sanhedrin and they said, "We have to obey God rather than men. We can't help but do that. It's our obligation." Those who know God have great boldness and courage for God. They do great exploits for God. And those who know God are those who are willing and prepared to give themselves entirely for God's work and even to the end. And they have great thoughts and know how to worship him. The fourth and my final mark of those who know God is that those who know God have great contentment in God. They have contentment in God, able to rest and relax in the reality that God, who is sovereign over all of creation, over all of life, of all circumstances, is one who can be trusted. In chapter 3, King Nebuchadnezzar has set up this large idol. And you probably know the story if you've been a Christian for any length of time or you have read the Bible consistently. He set up a decree that anyone who did not bow down and worship this huge idol that he'd set up was going to be threatened with death in the furnace. And these three friends, these three compatriots, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, could not bow down, by conviction, could not bow down and worship this idol. And so they measured the cost, they counted the risk, and they remained steadfast. You'll notice their testimony. Daniel chapter 3, verse 18. Here's their reply to the king. "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand." Look at verse 18. "But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." In other words, we trust God. We believe that God can deliver us. But even if he does not, our conviction remains. Those who know God have great contentment in God, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the outcomes. And we know the story. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fiery furnace, and they survived. They were walking about in there, as Daniel describes in chapter 3. But there was another person with them. There was four. The king says, "Didn't we just throw three in? But there's a fourth person in there. You can see through the flames." And that fourth person was none other than the Lord Jesus Christ, a theophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus, the second person of the Trinity. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego rested entirely in the providence and in the sovereignty of God. Those two words sometimes are confused. The idea that God is sovereign means he is ruler. He is supreme over all of his creation. The providence of God means that he is caring for us. He cares for his people. He has a purpose in achieving something that we cannot see, perhaps, but he has a purposeful intention in the circumstances of our lives. Let me share with you one more time, if you permit me, the story of my life, because my life, of course, has been marked in these last few years. And I have a hard time, as you can tell, once again, talking about it. These years, these last 7 years, or perhaps seven to go, or if I continue with my parents' genetic makeup, another 25 years, is not what I planned. I had no intention of living a single life. This is not what I envisioned or we talked about when we were talking about our 60s and 70s. We had plans. We had plans to go on long trips and explore places we'd never been to before. And if I was left to myself, if God was not in the picture, I would easily become very angry about losing her. This is not what I had planned. This is not what I had envisioned. It's not what we'd envisioned. It's not what we talked about. But by God's grace, and because I have some measure of confidence that God is sovereign over all the affairs of our world and of my life, I can trust in His providence. I can trust that He has a purpose. I can't see it. I'm blind to it. But God has a purpose beyond my life that He is achieving for His glory. You may have heard this comparison before. Someone has said, our life is like a weaver's loom. We don't have weavers in this part of the world any longer, but many places there are. I saw them in India. A weaver's loom, and what's happening on the top and the bottom is very different. On the top is a beautiful pattern being developed, but underneath are the ragged edges and hanging threads on the weaver's loom. And God, in His providential purpose, has a pattern that He's developing on the top. We can't see it from where we sit. All we see are these ragged threads hanging down below. But God sees a purpose and a pattern that's being established. As we grow in our knowledge of God, my appeal to you, brothers and sisters, is that you would get to know God. Not just to know about Him, but that we actually know Him in our daily personal experiences of life. We're going to conclude with that song that Emily and the team introduced us to. I think it might be new to us, but we're going to sing it one more time. It's a confession. And the words, come on up, team, and assemble as I read these words. When I fear my faith will fail, Christ will hold me fast. When the tempter would prevail, He will hold me fast. I could never keep my hold through life's fearful path, for my love is often cold. He must hold me fast. Let's sing that one more time with the worship team and make this our confession as we recognize God's ultimate sovereignty and His purpose being achieved in our lives. Let's stand together as the team leads us.